Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Donnas singing Who Invited You to start us off today, dedicated to Mikaela and Tariq Salahi, the reality TV wannabes who crashed the White House state dinner last week, and to the Secret Service officers who get fired for letting them in, who invited them. Or maybe it was the Afghans serenading our troops. But that party crash story was a nice distraction from real news for Thanksgiving weekend, right? Hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving weekend. Good morning, everyone. Then there was Tiger Woods' accident. The Daily News called it Tiger's worst drive. Though in my house, the big media news of the weekend was that Mr. Monk is finally figuring out who killed Trudy. But this week, the president has his own reality shows to worry about. Today, he will unveil a plan to shame mortgage lenders into avoiding more foreclosures, if he can find any shame to tap. Tomorrow night is the Afghanistan speech, complete with an exit strategy, we are told. Thursday, it's a jobs summit. And the president announced that he will personally attend the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit while he's in the neighborhood anyway, picking up his Nobel Peace Prize. This seriously is one of the most important weeks of the Obama presidency so far. Susan Page, USA Today, Washington bureau chief, former Newsday White House correspondent, is with us to talk about all of this and to take your calls. Hi, Susan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, it's great to be back with you.
And let's take this somewhat in chronological order and take some listener calls on a few of the items. Listeners, how would you shame a bank into restructuring a mortgage? I think the president may need your help on this one. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. For these mortgage lenders who the president says should be restructuring more loans rather than foreclosing on as many homes, how do you shame them? 212-433-WNYC. We want your ideas. 433-9692. You bad boy, you're no better than Bernie Madoff. Will that work? Make them write their names on the board 100 times like Bart Simpson. I will not be needlessly cruel and heartless just to make an extra $2. I will not be cruel and... Or what's a better way? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. How do you shame a bank into not foreclosing on somebody? Susan, how will the president try to shame these banks?
Well, I think he's using the bully pulpit to try to do that. But, boy, it's a high order since the prospect of all this money that the federal government has poured into short banks has not prompted them to show the kind of consideration for borrowers that the White House had hoped. I'm not sure how you do it with words alone, with shame.
Of course, that assumes the existence of shame somewhere in their makeup. And that, you know, that's not just a slur. I mean, why think that a bank as an institution has any shame? It's not in any corporate charter that I've ever seen.
Well, banks do. I agree that it's a tough task. I mean, but banks do rely on, to some degree, on goodwill, right? There is always the prospect of the hammer of the federal government coming out after them, I guess, if they get everyone too angry with them. But generally, I think banks, like a lot of institutions, respond to legal action, respond to either getting money to do something or losing money if they don't do something. Generally, words alone that's tough.
Yeah. Well, he's been trying to shame the insurance companies into going along with his health reform proposals. That's worked really well. Maybe you should hire private investigators, then threaten to expose all the bankers' extramarital affairs. That'll shame them.
Or crash their social events.
Nah, he might have a little sensitive spot there. But seriously, why not use the law or regulation rather than shame? Is this Tim Geithner being too close to Wall Street or what?
Well, the White House has been kind of reluctant. The White House has been pretty, as everybody knows, pretty friendly to big financial institutions. You know, they see them as too big to fail. They see them as worthy of federal bailouts. And they have been unwilling to do some of the things that more populist members of Congress have been proposing to pressure banks. I mean, some people think that we know from our USA Today Gallup polling, people tend to think of Obama increasingly as a liberal president. But on these issues, he's been pretty much in line with previous presidents that are centrist or even Republicans in terms of what's appropriate to do in terms of financial regulations of banks.
And listeners, we have that question up on our webpage and our Facebook group as well. How do you shame a bank into not foreclosing on someone's home? We really think the president needs your help on this. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or to the Brian Lehrer Facebook group, or call in, though our lines are already full with people wanting to help the president, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Carolyn Manhattan, how would you do it?
Hi. I would not go the negative. I would go the positive. And I would tell the banks to remind the banks that they have a community responsibility and that they should be helping the community to grow and not shatter it.
Carol has a lot of hope. Carol, thank you for not being jaded. Leonard in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. How do you shame the banks?
Well, first of all, I do not believe that anything you can do can shame a banker. And I think what has to be done is some kind of regulation that can be enforced to accord them the action to do what is the right thing. There's no way you can shame a banker.
Thank you. And Sheldon, also in Forest Hill, says place the shame somewhere else, not on the banks directly?
No, put it on to Geithner and Summers, et al., and any of these other whiz kids. Let them figure it out. They're the ones who structured this whole deal. Let them put the heat on their chums.
Thank you. Shame the Treasury Secretary. How about that one, Susan Page?
Well, he's been come in for quite a bit of flack lately. He calls for his head and blame for some of the things that have gone wrong. You know, there is, of course, a possibility that the White House does not actually think that shaming the banks would work, but that they want to show that they're concerned about all the foreclosures. And you could look at the job summit we've got coming up on Thursday with the same idea that maybe it'll have results. But even if it doesn't show results, at least it demonstrates the White House is thinking about the things that are bothering a lot of Americans.
But blah, that's lip service when you put it that way.
God, that's shocking, isn't it? Lip service in politics? Wow.
Well, this is supposed to be different, and they're supposed to have levers of power that they're able to pull and willing to pull.
Yeah, and of course, President Obama, as a candidate, talked about being a different kind of president, and it's been hard, I think, for him to deliver on that promise this very eventful past 11 months.
Which banks or mortgage lenders are these primarily who he wants to shame? Are these the same big banks, Wall Street companies that are getting bailout money? Are these community lending institutions? Or who in particular is he trying to shame, and will he name names?
I don't know the answer to the question about whether he'll name names, but I know that the White House has been more concerned about what these big banks have done than some of the community banks. You know, community banks as a group have not suffered the same kind of setbacks that the big banks have because they were more cautious in the loans that they let out. So I think this is really targeted at those big banks that got the big bucks when they needed them this year.
Jamie in Oakland, New Jersey, wants to aim the shame in yet another direction. Hi, Jamie.
I think the shame should go on people who signed these mortgages. They knew what they were signing. They should have known. Just like everybody goes to work and gets a paycheck for the work they did, the bank signed that contract. It gave them the money. They bought the house. They're entitled to their money.
Thank you very much. And Brendan on the Upper West Side has one last example of shame before we move on to Afghanistan. Hi, Brendan.
I think the best type of shame is do what WNYC do for their fund drive. You get Ira Glass to call them up and shame them on the air.
If Ira Glass can't do it, and I think he gives an even better speech than President Obama does, then nobody can. Brendan, thank you very much. My guest on WNYC, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, Susan Page. And let's go on to the Afghanistan speech coming tomorrow night, Susan. Much anticipated, obviously, and which will reportedly include a troop buildup of roughly 30,000 Americans, and they hope a few thousand more from other NATO countries, but also an exit strategy with a timetable. And we'll get to the exit strategy in a minute, but there was also now the question of how to pay for this surge. At $1 million per troop per year estimated, that would be $30 billion a year when we're facing historic deficits already and they're trying to do health reform et cetera. We basically borrowed $1 trillion under Bush for the Iraq War, and House Appropriations Committee Chairman David Obie is proposing an Afghanistan war surtax. Listen.
If we have to pay for the health care bill, we should pay for the war as well.
How?
By having a war surtax. The problem in this country with this issue is that the only people who've been asked to sacrifice are military families.
Susan Page, there's a lot in that little soundbite. And one thing is that the health care bill, everybody says, has to be deficit neutral, right? That's why they have these taxes on Botox and other things to pay for it. Is he serious that the war plan should be deficit neutral?
Well, I think Dave Obie is serious, and he's in a position to make that view matter because of his chairmanship. And this is a way, you know, it's clear President Obama will have a lot of audiences tomorrow night, but I think his number one audience are Democratic members of Congress who do not agree with him on Afghanistan and who could make it very difficult for him to proceed. And it's one of the things that we see happening in this critical month that's coming up is the interaction of issues. You know, for instance, if the reaction to President Obama's speech tomorrow night is very negative from Democrats, including on this financing issue, is that going to make it harder over the next couple of weeks to cut a deal on health care in the Senate? I think it very well might. It might make liberals in Congress less willing to make a compromise on the public option or other things. And it gives people grounds in terms of this concern about federal spending to fight the health care bill. So I do think Congressman Obie's threat is a serious one, and it's one that you hear also from some Republicans who are inclined to support the buildup of troops in Afghanistan, but who are concerned about deficit spending.
So, listeners, would you support an Afghanistan war surtax to pay for this surge? We're done with the methods of shaming the banks now. We're going to do a separate round of calls on financing the Afghanistan war surge, seriously. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You probably didn't like the borrowing that was done during the Bush administration when they put the war off budget, so to speak. Would you support an Afghanistan war surtax to pay for the surge, especially if you're in favor of the surge? We'll be debating this a lot over the coming days. We have Thomas Friedman coming to spend an hour with us in the green space tomorrow. He's against any buildup in Afghanistan. We'll have pro voices on as well Wednesday morning after the president speaks. We know you, our listeners, are divided on this question. Some of you think it's necessary to go and finish the job that we started after 2001. Others of you oppose it. But if you support this surge in Afghanistan or the idea of escalating in Afghanistan, how should we pay for it? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And you mentioned the reluctance of the Democrats, who are now becoming more against this war. And I wonder if the president will get more Republican than Democratic support for this speech tomorrow night. Here is Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on ABC This Week yesterday.
And when we go Christmas shopping, we're going to be buying our products from China, who are lending us money to fight the war.
Sorry, that's Senator Bernie Sanders. We'll get to Senator Graham in just a second. Do we have Senator Graham ready to go? Here he is.
This is not just any place on the planet. This is the place where the Taliban took control after the Russians left, aligned themselves with Al-Qaeda, and attacked this nation and killed 3,000 Americans. And I hope the president will tell the world, our troops, and anybody listening Tuesday, that will never happen again.
So, Susan Page, will the Republicans be more pro-Obama than Democrats on this?
You know, Republicans are more supportive of the idea of kind of staying the course, increasing U.S. troops in Afghanistan. But they're going to have, we've already seen a lot of criticism from Republicans on other aspects of the speech, including the idea of setting out a timetable, even a rough timetable, for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Because Republicans argue that's just a signal to the opposition to stick around because we're eventually going away. It is, I think, difficult for a Democratic president to be counting on Republicans to stand up and support him on a controversial issue like this one.
Barry in Midtown. Surtax to support the surge?
No, I would not.
Okay. You want to say anything else?
Yeah. Why don't they bring back war bonds? For example, I call my stockbroker and I buy 100 bonds for Afghanistan. Not a problem.
Why is that different than a tax?
Pardon?
Why would that be better than a tax?
Well, it's completely different. It's not a tax. It's not coming straight out of my pocket. If I get a war bond, then, you know, it's a bond that I own. It's a bond that I'm actually buying through, through correct sources. It can be tax deductible. It can be, and if the bond is correct, is done correctly, you know, through the stock market, I could possibly still get, you know,
some returns on it. Barry, thank you very much. And now, war bonds, going back to our World War II history, Susan Page, were not just an investment but an act of patriotism. And the other thing in the David Obey clip was to say that the president can't just ask for sacrifice from the families of the troops. That's what Bush did. And if we're going to have another big war like we had in Iraq, then the president needs to ask for more sacrifice from the American people as a whole, and that's why he proposes the tax. Do you think we're going to hear that kind of sacrifice? I mean, even John McCain, who, of course, was his opponent in the presidential race, was aghast that President Bush never asked for more sacrifice from the American people.
I do not. I mean, we'll see tomorrow night, and it's not like I've seen a draft of the speech. But I would be really surprised if we heard of a big call for sacrifice. You know, the concern by the administration is that public support for this war in Afghanistan already has been on the slide. We did a poll last week, and 4 out of 10 Americans say it's time to start withdrawing U.S. troops. Not to send more. The argument I think we'll hear from the president is that it is in U.S. interest to continue this war to conclusion, that it's in our interest in terms of fighting terrorism to stay there. But I understand the argument that Senator McCain and others have made that that after in these two wars and also in the period after 9/11 that Americans weren't asked to sacrifice the way Americans have in previous generations with other conflicts and tasks that were ahead. I think that's a powerful argument.
Alex in Times Square supports the surge and the tax. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Brian. Nice to see you. What I wanted to mention was that if they put money dedicated exclusively for the war, exclusively for fighting, it could be the start of something very big where the American public starts demanding that their tax dollars get spent on specific things that they want to get it spent on. So instead of just the money disappearing into a large fund and people just being, you know, not really accountable for what happens to it, there'll be a much closer accounting for what goes on in government spending, not just for the military, but as a whole.
Alex, thank you very much. And in a way, Susan Page, we are seeing that with the debate over paying for the health care bill, going back to this idea that this big health care bill needs to be deficit neutral, and now Obi saying, well, the surge needs to be deficit neutral. You know, it does reflect that particular value rather than all our tax money going into a black hole, even if they can't do it for everything.
You know, that's true, although for all these causes, members of Congress have the same targeted group to pay for it, which would be the wealthy. I heard one Democratic member of Congress say yesterday that he wouldn't support a war surtax unless it was targeted at those who made households that made $250,000 a year or more, which is the same group that the healthcare financiers are heading toward. And there may be some limit to the ability to target the wealthy to pay for these things.
Although in healthcare, everybody who's uninsured at work would be required to buy insurance out of their pocket, and they would set a limit. And as you know, the different bills are different in the House and Senate, but maybe it would be 8% of your income or something like that. But there would be sacrifice asked for more down the line on that.
That's true. Sacrifice or really an obligation, maybe more than a sacrifice, that you'd be obliged, whether you wanted to or not, to be covered by health care.
What's the president's plan for paying for this surge? If this estimate of $1 million per troop per year or about $30 billion a year is accurate?
Well, I haven't heard of any specific plan to finance it. What we do know the president's pledged to do is to put the wars back in the general budget so it's not off budget the way it was during the Bush administration. So the plan is to make it part of this overall, the overall federal budget. The budget plan comes out usually the first week of February. This next February will be the first one that fully reflects the Obama administration, and we think the wars will be a part of that. So if without any kind of specialized war funding, it'll come out of the income taxes and other federal government revenues.
Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, with us for another couple of minutes. Now on the exit strategy, which we are also expecting to hear from the president tomorrow, a surge and an exit strategy all in the same breath would be a very different kind of war speech. Here is William Kristol on the Fox News Sunday Roundtable on how long this surge will probably take to work in his view.
It's a winnable war. The delay makes it a little harder, but it still remains winnable. 2010 will be a tough year, I think, because the surge won't really have its effect until late in 2010, and the president needs to prepare the American public. There are no instant results. We can't be looking for the off-ramps when we're just beginning the build-up. 2011, I think, could be a year of decisive progress. The president's got to commit to this, therefore, for the rest of his first term, I think. He can win this war. We could win this war in 2012 and achieve a huge amount of good. This is an opportunity. Pakistan is improving. If Afghanistan can be stabilized and it can improve there, you could really stabilize Southeast Asia, which would be a huge victory in the global effort to set back Islamic jihadism.
Now, Susan Page, that's William Kristol, of course, coming from his neoconservative perspective, and he doesn't like the idea of announcing an exit strategy timetable in the first place, but would the Obama timetable likely be similar to the Kristol one? We won't even see the positive effects of a surge until late 2010, so 2011 would be the year that things really start going well, and 2012 would be the year of victory. Boy, it's hard to sit here in 2009 still and say all that's going to happen.
It is, but you know, if the president approves sending another 30,000 U.S. troops, which is what we expect, it'll take most of 2010 to get them there. You know, you can't snap your fingers and get all those troops there. You have to continue the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. You know, expect most of the combat units to be out of there by the end of August, and then you start redirecting as you're redirecting troops to Afghanistan. So that is the kind of timetable that you're left with, and you can see how unpalatable that is, especially, I've got to say, for members of Congress who are going to be going before voters at the end of 2010. While the surge, if we want to call it that, while the surge in Afghanistan has just been completed, and the good news that we hope comes out of that has not yet begun. That's a problem with health care, too. It takes, you know, the full benefits of the big provisions of the health care plan probably won't start to go into effect until 2014, which is also a ways down the road.
Which is a political liability for the president as well. There was an op-ed in the New York Times yesterday by Paul Starr that said rather than focus on the public option, focus on quick implementation of universal health care for one reason, so that people will see results by the time Obama is running for re-election in 2012. Otherwise, they know how they're being taxed, but they don't see their insurance kicking in.
It's a big problem. But one of the issues is, for financial reasons, it helps the budget calculations if you delay implementation. Because once you go to the universal coverage requiring everybody to buy insurance, you have to then start the subsidies, which is the big cost item for health care. You can't require people to buy health care and not help lower and moderate income families to buy it.
Health care. Does the Senate debate actually begin this week on the floor?
The Senate debate is supposed to begin today and really officially begin today and begin truly in earnest tomorrow. So that'll be big.
And here is Senator Ben Nelson, a Democrat who still may vote for a filibuster.
If the public option is wrong, if the class act is still in it, if there are a whole host of other items that are the same as they are right now, I wouldn't vote to get it off the floor.
So that's how hard that's going to be. What was the class act that he referred to? Do you know?
I don't know.
That may have been a a tax on the wealthy. I'm not sure if that's what he was referring to. We have now plastic surgeons and their patients objecting to the idea of a 5% tax on plastic surgery as one of the methods to pay for it. But you wonder, should that really be considered the practice of medicine anyway? You know, if somebody goes out for a nice haircut, is that medicine? And if you get plastic surgery to get your crow's feet removed, you know, does that go in the same category as cancer treatment under the law?
Yeah, those are good questions. I'm all for taxing that stuff.
The jobs summit on Thursday, before we run out of time.
Yeah.
I mean, again, healthcare debates starting on the Senate floor, the Afghanistan speech tomorrow night, and the jobs summit on Thursday. What will actually happen there?
And November unemployment numbers out Friday, don't forget.
Yes.
I think that's why
the job summit is Thursday, isn't it?
That is right. And on Friday, the president will be in Allentown, Pennsylvania, to start meet with workers. He's going to do that increasingly often. The White House says go out and meet with people who have jobs or looking for jobs, hoping not to lose their jobs. I think we're going to hear talk about green jobs, about expanding exports, and so on at the job summit on Thursday, and some discussion of legislation. But you know, the legislation to stimulate jobs runs into the same problems that we've talked about with Afghanistan and with healthcare, which is that it costs money.
And who's going to be at this so-called summit? Why do they call it? Usually if it's a summit, it means he's sitting down with Gordon Brown and Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
Well, who's at the healthcare summit?
They released a list yesterday of a bunch of business leaders. They had a Google and several other companies who are going to come, some economists, some labor leaders, a group of about 130 people, and they're going to have breakout sessions, and they're going to talk a lot.
The Eric Schmidt, Randy Weingarten administration sits down with, well, I don't know, we'll see, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Thank you for previewing a very important week for the country, never mind for the president. Thank you very much.
Brian, thanks very much.
Brian Maron, WNYC.